This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا
العلي العظيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's president roundly rejects direct talks with the U.S. on the 2015 deal, saying Tehran sees no benefit in such negotiations. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says his country has received another Iranian-built oil tanker. And a new poll shows Brazil's leftist presidential hopeful Lula da Silva has extended his lead over incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by 12 percentage points. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Iran's president has rejected direct talks with the United States to revive the 2015 deal, saying that such negotiations have no benefit. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Ebrahim Raisi said the interests of the Iranian nation are not based on direct negotiations. He said it is now up to the U.S. to make a final decision on the revival of the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi also commented on new U.S. sanctions on the country. He said why the American side takes such measures if it wants an agreement. He emphasized that the sanctions removal must be accompanied by a guarantee in order to achieve a lasting agreement. Elsewhere, Raisi stressed that a progress in the JCPOA revival talks also requires the resolution of the safeguards issues with the UN nuclear agency. Iran has repeatedly said that a deal is possible if the U.S. acts realistically. Iran's president says cooperation among countries targeted by U.S. sanctions will make them stronger.
The relationship between countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., such as Iran, Russia, or other countries, can overcome many problems and issues and make them stronger.
The Iranian president said Americans think that by imposing sanctions against a country, they can stop it, but they are wrong. Referring to the JCPOA revival talks, Raisi censured the Western states for proposing to hold negotiations while at the same time imposing new sanctions. He said they need to demonstrate goodwill for the revival of the 2015 deal. Raisi is in Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Russian counterpart. Raisi said Iran and Russia can offset the effects of U.S. sanctions by joining their forces. The two presidents underscored a joint resolve to enhance the strategic ties. Vladimir Putin said relations with Iran are positively developing.
Relations between Russia and Iran are developing on all the vectors that have been formed in previous years. We are in the final stage of working on a new major treaty between Russia and Iran, which will mark the developing of relations at the level of a strategic partnership.
Putin said a delegation from Russia with representatives of 80 large companies will visit Iran next week. The Russian president welcomed Iran becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. On Wednesday, Iran signed an SCO memorandum of obligations and arrangements, getting one step closer to becoming the ninth member of the regional body. Iran's accession is expected to be finalized by April 2023. We have reached out to Eurasia and Caucasus Affairs expert Ahmed Qasemzadeh to discuss the importance of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He believes the SCO can be considered the NATO of the East. Take a listen.
Regarding the significance of Iran's membership in the SCO, it should be noted that the organization includes several countries such as China, India, with a high population, almost half world population, with major economic benefits for member states. I can also refer to security matters. The SCO summit can be considered as the NATO of the East, and that includes the economic, political, and security spheres. It can bring about the interests and benefits for member states.
The Russian energy minister says his country will sign a deal to construct a new pipeline to China to replace Nord Stream 2 gas link to Europe. Alexander Novak made the revelation during a visit to Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. He said Moscow and Beijing would ink deals on the delivery of, quote, 50 billion cubic meters of gas per year. The future Force 2 pipeline in Siberia would fuel China's energy-hungry economy, partly via Mongolia. The Russian minister also said gas exports to the EU would drop by around 50 billion cubic meters this year. The new announcement comes amid Russia's energy row with Europe. The Nord Stream 2 was designed to double the flow of Russian gas to Germany through the Baltic Sea. However, Germany halted the project in the wake of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. Moscow has also stopped supplies to Europe via Nord Stream 1 pipeline amid sanctions. France has announced price caps for home energy prices. Now many are upset that the caps will not begin until next year, as the government has done nothing to restrict the price of petrol. Rami Mazouri reports from Paris.
As Europe endures its worst energy crisis in 50 years, the French government has promised state intervention will put caps on electricity and home gas prices, but not until next year. France will limit power and gas price increases for households at 15% in 2023. However, the delay means the caps will only arrive after a few more excruciating months, which are likely to see a further boost to the already skyrocketed prices. Many said the plan was not enough, because 15% still represents a massive and historic increase for the average citizen. 15% is almost three times the current and record rate of inflation, and over 40 times the average monthly increase in wages so far in 2022.
Everything is increasing in prices, and everyone sees that, from the average person to the prime minister. The government says the economic and financial context aren't good, but they have used this reason for years in order to avoid helping the average person. We are worried for this winter.
The government received a lot of criticism for not including any new measures to protect consumers at the petrol pump. A recent poll showed that over 40% of France wants a return of the Yellow Vest movement. They began their still ongoing weekend marches in November 2018 due to the high cost of gasoline. Two-thirds of French gas prices are caused by taxes. Gas taxes are regressive and not progressive because they hurt the poor more than they hurt the wealthy.
We see inflation everywhere, at the supermarket, at the fruit stand, but especially with petrol prices. Transportation is so much more expensive. We're told that we simply have to adapt and cut back, but I think the government could have done more to help us.
France is the rare Western nation which has already in 2022 embraced the socialist-inspired concept of state-enforced price caps. The result has been that France has the lowest inflation rate across the entire European Union this year. The newly announced price caps will cost the state 16 billion euros. That amount is dwarfed by the years of neoliberal and austerity-minded measures which have given hundreds of billions in bailouts, tax breaks, and advantages to the wealthy and corporate classes. Rami Mazaheri, Paris.
Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro says his country has received a new oil tanker from Iran.
We have just taken delivery of a ship with the most advanced engineering and technology in the world, built by the Iranians, commissioned by us, and that is now coming to serve as a cargo ship for our revolutionary PDVSA.
Based on a contract between Tehran and Caracas, Iran will deliver a total of 4 oil tankers to Venezuela. The two countries are both targeted by U.S. sanctions. In recent years, they have expanded their cooperation, especially in the energy sector. In June this year, the presidents of Iran and Venezuela signed a 20-year document to further expand bilateral relations. The document focuses on petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political cooperation. It was signed during Maduro's visit to Tehran. Just weeks ahead of Brazil's presidential elections, an opinion poll shows incumbent leader Jair Bolsonaro is lagging behind his main rival, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. According to a survey by the Data Folia Institute, the far-right president could get 33% of the votes against 45% for Lula da Silva in the first round. The survey expects a runoff in which Lula da Silva would win by 54% of the ballots against 38% for Bolsonaro. That shows a rise in popularity for the leftist veteran politician since last week. Bolsonaro has lost much of his popularity due to his contentious management of the COVID pandemic and economy. Earlier, he said he will retire from politics if he fails to win the vote next month. UN Special Rapporteur Elena Duhan has presented her report to the World Body's Human Rights Council. The scathing report recounts effects of unilateral sanctions. It points out how such measures by the U.S. severely impact economies and lives of people, especially in the case of Iran. Still, the question is whether the U.S. will be held to account over the sanctions, or the report can result in preventing these measures.
Elena Duhan is the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Back in May, she paid an 11-day visit to Iran to assess the impact of sanctions on the country. During her trip, she met with Iran's human rights officials and members of non-governmental organizations. She has now released her final report on the visit and made her presentation of her findings at the UNHCR. In her report, Duhan criticized the unilateral sanctions imposed on Iran. She has also called for the removal of unilateral coercive measures and asked the U.S. to come up with mechanisms of compensation for the victims of such measures. She also noted that decades of sanctions have affected Iranian people's lives and have particularly hit the low-income section of the society. Duhan also noted that the use of unilateral sanctions, secondary sanctions, and overcompliance has had an adverse effect on the broad spectrum of human rights, civil, political, economic, social, and cultural development. Iran has suffered from the extension of U.S. jurisdiction in the international banking transactions due to the involvement of U.S. correspondent banks or payments in U.S. dollars, which has not only caused serious disruptions and delays in the provision of basic goods, but also has seriously impeded Iran's engagement in international cooperation.
The use or threat of secondary sanctions or civil and criminal penalties constitutes de facto a new form of reprisals towards individuals, states, and companies, considered to be associated with targeted entities or to circumvent unilateral sanctions regimes, despite the recognized illegality of this application of extraterritorial jurisdiction of states. Secondary sanctions and overcompliance make states, businesses, humanitarian organizations, and individuals look for alternative means to procure necessary goods, which results in growing costs, delays in delivery, growing risks of corruption and other types of transboundary crimes, and endanger the status of humanitarian organizations.
We will recall that the United Nations General Assembly in December 2020 Resolution 75181, 131 countries voted, unilateral coercive measures and legislation are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, the Charter of the United Nations, and the norms and principles governing peaceful relations among states. And it's quite simple under the charter to, so the U.S. cannot intervene and apply sanctions against your country because it's contrary to the sovereign equality of nations.
Yet, there have been opposition to her statements and places of visit. Criticism of her visit to Iran and a scathing report on the cruel U.S. sanctions have been led by Hillel Noyer, executive director of UNW. He has argued that Duhan is a lobbyist for repressive regimes, yet Noyer himself is guilty of that. He has been a staunch supporter of the Israeli regime and supports the oppression and cruel human rights violations against Palestinians. This in turn makes him void of being impartial and a judge on human rights.
During her speech, Elena Duhan, who visited Iran recently, gave first-hand accounts of how the U.S. sanctions have severely impacted the lives of Iranians over decades. She particularly pointed out how secondary sanctions are compounding the problem. Qasem Gharibabadi, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, was also present at the session. He rejected U.S. claims of exempting food and medicines from sanctions. He called it a whitewash, saying those life-saving items never make it to Iran.
Right after the 1979 victory of the Islamic Revolution, the U.S. imposed economic, trade and financial sanctions with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995. Since the mid-2000s, a series of executive orders created a broad framework of prohibitions and bans against Iran. Those restrictions intensified after 2010 and covered the energy sector and other key economic sectors. The sanctions against Iran's financial sector included designations and asset freezes affecting the Iranian Central Bank and commercial banks. The EU adopted comprehensive economic, trade and some other sanctions against Iran since 2010. Those measures were intensified in the following years with an oil embargo in 2012. Those sanctions were lifted or were temporarily frozen following the 2015 nuclear deal. But back in May 2018, the U.S. began to unilaterally impose sanctions against Iran after former President Donald Trump's administration abandoned the agreement. He also launched what he called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran at the time, targeting the Iranian nation with the toughest ever sanctions. Trump failed in his anti-Iran campaign, but his anti-Iran measures have hurt the Iranian population.
Iranian people are the main innocent victims of the inhumane unilateral coercive measures that have been imposed against them under the failed so-called policy of maximum pressure, which is designed and implemented as a means of war to commit crimes against humanity, persecution and genocide against our people.
Strict bans on banking transactions have made it impossible for Iran to access critically needed medicine and medical equipment over the past years. Iran has described those sanctions as a crime against humanity.
And now over to reports of new border clashes between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Kyrgyzstan's Border Guard Service says several of its outposts have once again come under attack by Tajik forces. The service says its border guards have hit back by opening fire on Tajik positions along the frontier. Tajikistan says Kyrgyz forces have used heavy weaponry, shelling one of its outposts in seven villages. It says a civilian was killed and three others were wounded as a result. The latest flare-up follows a brief confrontation between the two Central Asian countries earlier this week. The governors of the provinces adjacent to the border are set to meet later in the day to try to defuse the situation. Border clashes are frequent between the two former Soviet states. Russia has urged them to cease hostilities. And that's a wrap for this hour's World News. Stay with us.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
Last Sunday marked the anniversary of 9/11, which paved the way for the US to invade and plunder West Asia and North Africa region under the excuse of countering terrorism. The US, which is a terrorist regime itself, named this exploitation as the Global War on Terror, which had nothing to do with countering terrorism. Rather, it was a tactic for draining the resources of countries under its occupation. And the worst thing is that all those who committed these crimes were never held accountable. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the second part. RT in an op-ed wrote, after 20 years of wandering in the geopolitical wilderness of the West Asia and Central Asia, America emerged a much weaker nation militarily, economically, and diplomatically. Compounding this diminishment was the fact that while America was engaged in its two-decade act of self-immolation, the rest of the world was not treading water, but rather moving forward, building their own capabilities, which, while not necessarily designed to confront the United States, put them in a far more adventurous position if the time ever came to do so. These lessons were magnified by the chaotic classroom of American democracy, where the world bore witness to the wild vacillations of policy and principle that came from a two-party system at war with itself. 8 years of the neoconservative aggression of George W. Bush was followed by 8 years of neoliberal deception under Barack Obama. The 4 years of Hobbes-driven chaos that was the Trump administration has in turn been replaced by 2 years of misguided and incompetent revanchism by a Biden administration operating under the premise that one can undo the damage done by decades of American policy failure by simply willing it away. American democracy, the ostensible shining city on the hill that was supposed to inspire the rest of the world to want to be like them and as such follow their lead, had been exposed as a Potemkin village, little more than a ghetto disguised as an upscale suburb. The world was able to see this transformation occur before its very eyes. Americans, on the other hand, remained blissfully unaware, coerced into ignorant submission by the false promise of unconstrained consumerism. Debts, however, must eventually be paid. 9/11 at 20 plus 1 reflects the reality of many of these bills, domestic and foreign, coming due. The 20 plus 1 anniversary of 9/11 finds the United States in a political civil war that threatens to exploit into partisan-driven violence of a scope and scale unseen since the original American Civil War. The dominance of the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency is very much in doubt, as global markets, fed up with American interference in their sovereign economic decisions, are dropping the dollar in favor of regional currency baskets. After chiding Russia as being little more than a gas station disguised as a nation, the United States and its allies find themselves in the position of motorists, stranded on a highway in the middle of a wilderness. Their fuel tanks empty and no gas station in sight, mainly because they closed all the stations before undertaking their journey. The economic sanctioning of Russia by the collective West has turned into an act of self-harm, with economies of Europe collapsing and America unable and or unwilling to save them. Al Jazeera English also wrote, the September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States ushered in a new era of hate crimes, racism, and xenophobia against Muslims. For Muslim Americans, the post-September 11 ramifications of Islamophobia continue as the 21st anniversary of the attacks is solemnly marked. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes against Muslims in the United States skyrocketed immediately after September 11, 2001, and are still on an upward trend. Muslims continue to be the target of hate, bullying, and discrimination as a result of the stereotypes that were perpetuated by Islamophobes and the media in the years following 9/11 attacks, said Hossam Ailush, executive director of Los Angeles chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, adding, 21 years after the attacks, Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence. After September 11, Ailush said, there was a perfect storm of American people and its government needing a common enemy. The unfortunate reality is there are people and organizations that benefit from perpetuating Islamophobia, bigotry, and war, he said.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Dr. Bathina, an honor to be at your presence, and thank you for being with us to discuss pressing issues in Syria.
Thank you very much, Marwa, for coming to Damascus. It's a pleasure having you.
Our honor. Dr. Bathina, I want us to begin with the ever-complicated game of geopolitics, that Syria has a great and big role in it ever since the dawn of history, but specifically in the past two decades. The Western and regional regimes are acting as if Syria is just post-war, and they're trying to find some sort of new ways to maneuver politically with Syria, especially with the on-stage now war between Russia and Ukraine being center stage at the moment. And the biggest issue that Syria is still facing with the four most challenging and pressing issues is the occupation of the U.S. Forces in the eastern part of the Euphrates. You have the occupation of the Turks in the north, occupation of the Israelis in the Golan area, in the Golan Heights, and their aggression, continuous aggression. And also, we have remnants of Daesh in certain areas, which are, by the way, in areas where the U.S. is still in Syria. But now, in what stage would you say Syria is right now, considering all these pressing challenges we just mentioned?
First, when the war started on Syria, there were only the Takfiri terrorists who are launching this war in all parts of Syria. Only when the Syrian Arab Army with its alliances with Hezbollah, with Russia, with Iran, were able to defeat these terrorists in most areas in Syria, those who were leading the war by proxy, exactly the parties you named, the U.S., Israel, Turkey, jumped into the ground and came in order to continue the mission of the terrorists whose mission was to destroy Syria, to destroy its identity, to destroy its institutions. And therefore, and as you mentioned also, it is paradoxical that Daesh, that the U.S. claims to be fighting, is there in the neighborhood, in the areas, in the domain where the U.S. Steals our oil and our wheat and the resources of the Syrian people. Therefore, we are at another stage, really, of fighting against occupation. So I see these four occupations you mentioned as another side of the coin of the terrorist war that was launched in Syria. And their mission is to continue trying to divide Syria, trying to subjugate the Syrian people, trying to strangle the Syrian people by stealing its resources, by enforcing these extremely horrible unilateral measures that are unknown in humanity, that are against all human and international law. But as the Syrian people defeated the terrorists, they are going to defeat all these occupations, and Syria will be back united. Syria is 10,000 years old. This city, Damascus, is the eldest continuously inhabited capital in the world. The question why? Because its people will always come out from the rubble and rebuild it. And the aggressors are always defeated. And those who occupy parts of our land will be defeated.
Well, it does not take two to realize that when something positive tries to happen in the region, you always have the United States of America trying and attempting to break that positive thing, like, for example, breaking the isolation of Syria. It wouldn't allow it, especially which would put Syria back on the regional scene heavily. Maybe by ensuring its military presence, pressing that they're there to help certain groups. But there's a certain rapprochement that's being spoken about in the media between Syria and Turkey, which is one of the biggest players in the global war against Syria. And but, I mean, when we talk about a rapprochement, we need to talk about trust. Where do you think Syria is on the ladder of trust with Turkey at the moment?
Well, I would like to draw your attention, Marwa, to the fact that we have 830 kilometers borders with Turkey. And if we didn't have these borders, those mercenaries from all over the world would not have been able to come to Syria. What I mean is that Turkey was the gateway for all the terrorists from all over the world to come to Syria. And Turkey was a major player in this terrorist war that was launched on Syria. And of course, it ended up by occupying part of our land when the terrorists could not do the job that it wanted them to do. Therefore, what we hear in the media, for us, it doesn't mean much really, because there is no real initiative on the ground. There is no real talk on the ground. I mean, countries do not start talking through media. And those who occupy our lands have to withdraw first, have to show goodwill that they don't have really the intent to occupy our land for a long period, and that they are ready to withdraw, and that they start withdrawing. At least they honor the agreements they made. Erdogan signed with the President Putin. He didn't honor the agreement he signed to withdraw and to let the M4 be free from Latakia to Aleppo. He didn't honor any of the agreements he did. And therefore, they are bubbling in the media. And as you notice, Syria did not say anything because it doesn't mean much to us. It's not serious unless we see serious steps towards this. Trust you build with somebody who's trustworthy, whose history shows that he is trustworthy, but he has to prove on the ground with action, as the Americans say, actions speak louder than words. So all what we hear is words. We need to see actions.
Well, this brings us to discuss the relationship of Syria with its allies this time, and that stood in support of Syria's territorial integrity and Syria's sovereignty against all that had happened. And one of the main allies of Syria is the Russian Federation. It helped fight terrorism and Western neocolonialism, but it's always found in pan-Arab media after every aggression that Syria is faced from the Israeli entity. We see that the media focuses on Russia, our pan-Arab media focuses on Russia negatively. And they say this because they say that because of Russia removing the S-300, this is a permissive move for the Israelis to attack Damascus. Therefore, they hold similar responsibility. And I know
that you might disagree with this. How would you explain the sideline behavior of Syria's main ally at a time when Israel does not miss a chance to try and break Syria militarily and economically?
Well, let me first comment in your sentence, pan-Arab media. Unfortunately, most of this pan-Arab media does not represent Arab ambitions and Arab rights and does not even reflect the truth about the Arabs. The second part of it is that Russia, as an ally, took the first double veto with China against Western intended aggression towards Syria on 4th of October 2011. Since that time, Russia has taken 17 vetoes against intended Western aggression towards Syria, and China joined Russia in 10 of these vetoes. So this is an ally that you can't trust. And then in 2015, as you know, Russia came to the ground with advisors, with Air Force help to the Syrian army to help the Syrian army in fighting terrorism. But all this, if you want, media war against Russia in Syria is to strengthen the enemy, really, and to try and make the people feel that Russia is not trustworthy, that we should not trust Russia. Russia today is fighting a war on behalf of humanity, really, because the war in the Ukraine is, in its truth, is a war between a Western hegemony and between the world that aspires to have its own independent decision and its own integrity. And therefore, Russia, of course, has its own geopolitical needs. And as allies, we understand each other and we agree with each other on any steps. But they did not mention that Russia and the Russian air forces and the Syrian air forces are leading attacks against terrorists in the northeast and the northwest of Syria. They didn't mention the effort Russia is making in order to prevent U.S. allies from partitioning Syria. They don't mention the positive side. We, as Syria, have a trustworthy ally in Russia. Every step, every move is agreed by both, both of us, and there's no problem at all. And just imagine that Syria without allies in the region, or Russia without allies. We need to really solidify our alliance. And I was talking to you off air that the strength of the West is that they get their alliances together, even to do wars and to do wrong things. So we should do our alliances together and strengthen them to do good things, to keep our identity, to keep our independence, to keep our integrity. All the media that tries to plant doubts, either against Russia or against Iran. I mean, there are many in the Arab media now, they say the problem is not Israel, it's Iran.
Definitely, and this is where I want to end off with the allies of Syria here, because it's no secret that Iran and Hezbollah played a great role alongside the Syrian Arab army in preventing the Takfiri terrorism from Syria and eliminating also from Iraq and Lebanon. But they are also being blamed in the Western mainstream media and Israeli media as well, as they being the reason that Israel is bringing out its weapons and bombing Syria. Have these allies become some sort of a burden for Syria because they are here to help, because that's why Israel is bombing?
No, not at all. The only burden in the region is the Zionist enemy. That is the only burden in the region. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before this war, as if Israel wasn't an aggressor before we strengthen our relation with Iran and before Hezbollah and Iran come to help Syria. Of course they will criticize, because this is against their agenda. The more we get together, the more angry they will feel. Now, I think the reason why the Zionist enemy and Western allies as well are very careful or very anxious about what's happening in the region is the plan to do a railway between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. This, for them, is a great threat. They say because it carries arms to Hezbollah. It's not because of that. Because it's going to make the region flourishing region, because it's going to do great service to the people of the region. We have to agree that the ultimate aim of all these wars against us is to prevent us from developing, from prospering, from becoming a major player in the region. That is their aim. And therefore, really, we have to learn that whatever they say, you know, we have to interpret it, analyze it, edit it, and refuse most of it.
Well, that concludes our first segment, but brings us with a great push to our second segment of the show to talk about most pressuring issues happening right here inside Syria, where the Syrian civilians are feeling the most of it, which is the economic hardships, because the calamity to the Syrian economy for over 10 years of Takfiri terrorism, Western illegal, unilateral, punitive measures, they cannot be underestimated, and they can be felt by the public. I mean, the heavy combat in Syria is probably over, the heavy bombardment campaigns. But the situation, it's becoming worse by the day economically, especially with the U.S. CSERS Act of 2019, the civilian, so-called Syrian Civilian Protection Act of 2019, and the U.S. looting more than $100 billion of Syrian oil and Syrian resources, where they are occupying land inside of Syria. And there might be some victories still going on the battlefield, and everyone recognizes them, but it's not really tangible to the citizens, but rather the losses are. In your views, how can Syria really survive this painful economic hardship?
Well, before answering this question, let me say something. Yeah. Yesterday, I was attending a lecture by Talal Abu Ghadali at Damascus University, and he said he was on the board of World Trade, International World Trade, and an important paragraph in that is that no country in the world has the right to impose sanction on any other country unilaterally without the approval either of the UN or the World Trade, or without the approval of a body, an international body. And therefore, what the US called Syrian Protection Act, it is actually a criminal act. It's not a protection act. It's a criminal act against the Syrian people. And I see in it a continuation of the terrorist war against Syria, because they failed to make Syria succumb, as you said in your introduction. So they turned now first to occupying the land directly, to robbing our resources. And I don't know how any country can claim to be leading in the world and yet under daylight steals the resources of another people. I mean, this is moral bankruptcy for any country. And so they turned to economic sanctions, to what is called CSERS Act, in order to strangle the Syrian people. Of course, this is accompanied with the media you mentioned, whether pan-Arab media or Israeli media or Western media, against Russia, against Iran, against Syria, against the steadfastness, in order to make the Syrian people give up and say, okay, we can't do anything. But if they read history, they know that this is not the Syrian people who are going to do that. The Syrian people are going to soldier on with finding new ways of survival. Yesterday, our President Bashar al-Assad reopened the Center for Excellence in Homs. This was first opened in 2009. 2011, the terrorists destroyed it. That was one of the first targets. That proves that they don't want us to be excellent, to be achievers. They want us to be followers of what they want us to do. Mm-hmm. Syria was able first to make this center carry on in its teaching in Latakia, in Damascus, everywhere, and now to rebuild this center. And yesterday, students went back to the center. Farmers went back to their lands. They are sowing, they are reaping, they are producing. Perhaps this the huge problem is an opportunity for Syria to be totally self-reliant in everything it wants. And the Syrian people are so creative and so determined and so rooted that no one will be able to uproot them.
Mm-hmm. Does that simply mean that with Syria mending its ties with certain Arab states that were against Syria at one point but now seem to have taken a U-turn, does that new relationship mean they might be willing to fund improvements in economics and development, social development, economic development inside Syria?
Well, that is a political decision, and I don't know whether it's a totally political decision or whether it has to do with those parties who convinced them at the beginning to finance the war. You saw foreign ministers on TV saying that they put $37 billion to finance the war on Syria. So if they now don't, the war doesn't help Syria, it is, for me, understandable, because they didn't want Syria to survive anyway.
But they did open new doors of communication with Syria, for example, like the UAE.
There are new doors, but they haven't yet reached the point of becoming essential for rebuilding in Syria. Because, as I said, you know, we don't know who can and who cannot do to political circumstances and to political decision. Syria is open, and Syria doesn't have a resentment. You know, even internally, President Bashar al-Assad started a reconciliation process many years ago, and it has got its fruition, really, in the country. And therefore, we look to the future. We are not people who work on resentment and who look into the past. What I mean is that, of course, after wars, countries will go back, will start relation, but on certain basis, on the basis of integrity, of dignity, and with full respect to those who sacrifice their lives in order to protect the independent decision of the country. Mm-hmm. That's most important.
And when you say that Syrians do not hold a grudge and do not resent, it's basically because of the bringing up. And bringing up means the role of women in the Syrian society. I mean, the global war in Syria had devastating impact on women. It also had shifted their roles in the workforce inside of Syria. But consequently, women are becoming increasingly influential in the public space in Syria and shaping Syria's future. I want to read an excerpt from your book, which I would love for you to sign for me when we finish our interview. But you say, I believe it is time Arab women learned...
From this book.
Yes, I will say the title of the book, which is Both Right and Left-Handed by Dr. Buthaina Shaban. It's about stories of Arab women in our region. And in this book, you practically say that I believe it is time Arab women learned not to fight men's battles while losing out themselves. I think our priority as women should be to help spread a feminist consciousness in every domain and across all categories, social categories, in order to be prepared for these struggles to come. You wrote this in the Both Right and Left-Handed in 1988.
Yeah.
Were Syrian women ready for the tsunami wave that struck in 2011, as it still has shock waves and ripples affecting the ability to create maybe even new unthinkable challenges for these women?
I don't think anybody was ready for this tsunami. I think the whole so-called Arab Spring, which is an Arab disaster, took everybody by surprise. But we quickly adapted to the situation and started to deal with it. And I really believe at times of crisis, as at other times, peaceful times, women have an extremely fundamental role to play. And in this war, as you said, women are the ones who actually bring up their children, who are the ones who plant in their heads the importance of the country, the sacrifice for the country. I mean, if you see the Syrian women whose sons would go to fight terrorists and that they would receive their bodies, first son and second son, and they would say, this is an honor for us because it is for the sake of the country. I mean, it takes really great bravery for a mother and great also belief, great faith in the country to be able to say that. Now, I wrote this book in the aftermath of the liberation also of Algeria. I made many interviews with Algerian women. And Algerian women said that we were fighting the political war, but without paying attention to our rights. And when the war was over, we did not get our rights. And what I meant is that during the war, when women are sacrificing and women are playing an important role in fighting this war, they should also think of their rights. The whole, not only women, men also should think of radicalizing the society, not just winning the war on the ground in the battlefield, but winning the social war, winning the economic war, winning the human war, winning the educational war. Therefore, that's what I mean, and I believe in that, really. I mean, I was a feminist, I'm still a feminist, but now I believe that I'm capable to fight not only for women, not only for Arab women and men, but for human being in general, everywhere. And therefore, there are basic rules that should apply that would make everybody happier. Well, but I don't believe in Western feminism.
But do you have a chance to survive as Arab women?
I think we always had a chance to survive as Arab women. But the problem is that our media and our culture is not turned into a mainstream. You know, I did a lot of research on Arab women novels, on Arab women writings. Before the First World War, there were 25 Arab journals owned, edited, published by women. Our history is great, but it is not written by our hands. It is not turned into a mainstream. And our feminism, Arab feminism, I claim, is a lot more sensible and courageous than Western feminism. The reason? Because it takes into account a very basic fact that men and women are different, and we do not want an equality. I don't want to look like a man or to be a man, but I want an equal opportunity. That's where the West made a huge mistake, and now neoliberalism is destroying men and women because they are turning even the cartoons for children into very abusive and very, very horrible, immoral way of doing things. Therefore, we are not only facing the West as women to survive, we are, the whole world is facing a horrible neoliberalism that is really destructive to our humanity, to our way of life.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shaban, for your time and for your contribution to our show.
Thank you very much, Marwa, and all the power to you. I think the world needs you, not only Arab women. The world needs your voice.
I'm humbled by your words. Thank you very much.
Mokeb, symbol of love. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, said, when his caravan arrived in the land of Karbala, O God, I take refuge with you from hardship and calamity. Then he told his caravan, a light as here is the place to dismount and set up our tents. This land is the place of shedding our blood, and our graves will be here. 40 days after the tragedy of Ashura, the famous companion of the Prophet, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, arrived in Karbala. According to a narration, the caravan of the captives of Karbala also returned to this land. The fifth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Baqir, peace upon him, says, Karbala is the place in which God spoke with Musa and whispered with Noah, and it is the most venerated land with God. Otherwise, God would not have entrusted his friends and the children of his prophet there. So visit our graves in Karbala. The 11th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, says, The signs of a faithful are five, one of which is the Arba'in pilgrimage. Imam Musa Sadr, who was abducted by the agents of the former Libyan ruler Muammar Gaddafi through complicity with the Zionist regime, writes, True Islam is the Islam of Hussein. Hence, Pilgrimage of Hussein, which followers of Hussein perform with knowledge, is thousands of times superior to thousands of Hajj pilgrimages which the followers of Yazid perform. This means that pilgrimage of Hussein is superior to Hajj and Arafah. Rather, thousands of superficial Hajj are not equal to pilgrimage of Hussein because real Hajj and true Islam were watered, grown, and revived by him. Service to the pilgrims of Imam.